From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. What did the 2016 elections say about the state of politics in North Carolina? We'll ask veteran political observer John Hood for his assessment. He calls the election important, but not necessarily transformational. The election helped ensure that two North Carolina congressmen will lead major conservative groups on Capitol Hill. You'll learn what kind of impact Mark Meadows and Mark Walker could have in Washington in the next couple of years. Plus, you'll hear from Walker himself. You'll also learn about the latest efforts to build North Carolina's Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Lawmakers want to avoid falling into debt to the federal government during the next economic downturn. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The havoc wreaked on North Carolina by Hurricane Matthew in the east and wildfires in the west have now focused attention on the state's so-called Rainy Day Fund. The fund's balance has grown steadily for the past couple of years, and now fiscal conservatives in the General Assembly are seeking ways to make sure that this big pot of money that's been set aside for emergencies is used properly. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation. She's been following the story about fiscal stewardship in North Carolina. Becky, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
So this special legislative session that happened just a few days ago, they really looked at needing to tap some of the funds that were in the Rainy Day Fund for victims of these two disasters, the hurricane and the wildfires. Good thing we had that money on hand.
Absolutely. You know, and towards the end of the session, there was some criticism of this conservative General Assembly for putting as much money aside. The Rainy Day Fund, the savings reserve, is as large as it has ever been in history. And there was some criticism of them for doing that. Well, then the hurricane hit, then the wildfire started, and all of a sudden those naysayers were saying thank you instead of being critical.
A couple $100 million, I believe, has been tapped out of that fund.
That's what the General Assembly did in this special session. That's why they came back to look at these funds, to get those down in those areas, on both the east and the west, to get help to those people that need it. You know, the damage has just been devastating. We have people that are without homes, without shelter, that don't have anything to eat, that have been staying in hotels, many times, you know, miles and miles away from their community, their families. We also have small businesses that have been very hard hit by this. Some infrastructure, things that local governments are controlled with, you know, water and sewer and roads and bridges and those kind of things, that we need immediate help with this. So the decision that was made by the General Assembly was for over $200 million to be sent immediately to these areas that need the help. Now, Donna, about half of that money was taken out of the reserve account. About half of it was taken out of the surplus in revenue. So, you know, again, what we're seeing are these signs of really strong leadership, of fiscal management, of making sure that, you know, all of the money is not only being used for the right thing to get help to people that need it, but has been taken out of the general fund and the savings reserve fund, so to keep those things solvent as well.
Now that there is adequate sources of funding to respond to emergencies like this in the Rainy Day Fund, you have some members of the legislature who are now thinking, you know, we might want to look closely at this fund, maybe start setting some parameters about how it's used or ask questions about how much do we really need. And in fact, they're already talking about it.
Right. And, you know, several good things have come of this. One of it is for us to go through a disaster relief procedure, if you will, with this money in hand. They're learning how to get the money the quickest way. When we have to do it through sort of some avenues, what is the best avenue with the most accountability, with measures put into place? And also, you know, there's federal money that is available for these kind of things. So one of the other things that they're doing is they're leveraging some of North Carolina funds in order to get federal funds. Now, I think it's important to note, too, in this action that they took, this $200 million, this is just the first phase that they're going to be allocating. There are still assessments being done at the state level as well as the federal level of exactly what the needs are, where they're needed, how much is needed. So one thing that I know you can expect when they come back in January is to revisit this. They have already said, as part of this bill and the discussion that we saw at the General Assembly, is this is phase one. We will be doing phase two and most likely doing phase three again. So, you know, this has been a great learning lesson, and we're coming out of this much stronger than we were than we went in, not only with the money set aside, but how you use this money, at what point you get it to people that need it, and then how do you work with federal partners and other partners, nonprofits, in to maximize every single resource that we have available.
How have legislators been deciding how much money goes into the rainy day fund? Are there rules already in place?
No, not really. And interestingly enough, again, because of this commitment, and I think because seeing how important this was, there's been a legislative research commission that's been going on since the long session stopped. They've been meeting regularly to look at these things, see what other states do, look what we need and how much we need to build up our reserve for these emergency kind of things. And so there is legislation afoot. It actually was just done in the last week or so by this legislative research commission, is recommending legislation that would require in our statute that 15% of any extra revenue, year-to-year revenue surplus, 15% would automatically, without any question, without any negotiation, would just, as part of the budgeting process, automatically go into a savings reserve account so that we continue to replenish this, we continue to build it up, so that North Carolina has this very important cushion when we're faced with the kind of things like we've been faced this fall.
And North Carolina's economy has been growing. Plus, add to that, there's been pretty strong fiscal stewardship, restraining the growth of government, restraining spending. So if that were to continue, potentially, that's a lot of money that could be going into the fund.
Right. And, you know, again, I really have to commend Governor McCrory and the leadership in the General Assembly, because there is extra revenue. North Carolina's economy is doing great. We're doing better than our neighbors. We're doing better than the national economy. We have a strong economy that results in extra revenue for the state. One temptation, Donna, would be just to spend it,
sure,
you know, to grow government, to create more programs, you know, to do that. They have taken another tact and gone in a different direction, is that, you know, what they're going to use that money for is to shore up the savings account, put that money aside so that, again, when North Carolina is faced with these disasters like we've had, we've got a cushion there in order to sustain that.
Is this legislative commission or committee that you've been talking mm-hmm. about looking at putting down specific parameters about what the fund could be used for?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they do outline that. And it's things like these natural disasters and then, you know, should the general fund run short? And this would really be in a circumstance where the economy takes a nosedive, where we go through another recession. And, you know, many economists are telling us that we're overdue for a recession, the way the pendulum swings back and forth in economies. So not only do we need to put this money aside for these natural disasters that we've experienced just recently, but also these economic disasters and these recessions, so that when we're short on money, we don't have to raise taxes in order to pay our teachers, pay our state employees, pay our law enforcement officers. So, you know, there's a lot of needs for having a savings account, just like you do in your family. I mean, just, you know, think about that, how important
sure.
it is to put some money aside for all kinds of things that may come up. And the General Assembly has designated what I think you and I would agree are sort of those emergency circumstances where you would need it, you know, not to go out and just spend it foolishly on shiny new objects. There are real needs that have been identified. And again, with the leadership that we have, you know, these are strong fiscal policies and ones that, as our listeners know, the John Lott Foundation has advocated for and worked for our entire existence. And so it's very rewarding to see that kind of fiscal responsibility really being implemented.
Becky, we obviously have a new governor who will be taking office. That would be Democrat Roy Cooper, the former attorney general. He's going to be proposing his own budget. He talked during the campaign about things that he felt the state needed to spend more on. So is there going to be a conflict there between those fiscal reformers in the legislature and a governor who may want to do some more spending?
It certainly appears that way. You know, one of the questions that some folks have asked is, okay, Roy Cooper, you want to do all this stuff. How are you going to pay for it? That's the million. That is literally the million. Right. That's the $51 billion question. And yes, I would anticipate. You know, what we're going to see too is a real, we'll see a clear line of what the priorities are coming out of the new Democrat governor and what the priorities are coming out of a very conservative General Assembly. And I suspect that we're going to see some differences there.
We've been talking with Becky Gray. She is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Becky, thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The votes have been cast, the results mostly finalized, and now it's time to ask, what does the 2016 election mean for the future in the United States and particularly in North Carolina? Joining us with thoughts on that topic is John Hood, longtime analyst of North Carolina politics and chairman of the John Locke Foundation. John, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
So you've had a chance to think about what happened with the 2016 election, and as you're assessing, what does this all mean? What have you said to yourself about what it actually means?
Well, the first thing that I've been trying to avoid is what I fear lots of other people have dived into, which is to overanalyze and draw sweeping generalizations on the basis of what is essentially a pretty rare fluke sort of a presidential race. Now, there were lots of other races, and they all tell us something important, but not necessarily something transformational about American politics or about North Carolina politics. I'm not trying to downplay the significance of the 2016 elections. All elections, including particularly the ones that are on the presidential cycle, so that you're in North Carolina, that determines not just presidency, but governor's race and council state races and other things. They always matter. They're always important. But to say that the 2016 election is transformational in some permanent sweeping sense, I think is a mistake. Both the presidential race nationally and the governor's race here in North Carolina were essentially ties. Now, you don't get to have a tie-breaking game, or you don't share the office. Somebody wins and somebody loses. And the wins and losses at the governor's race are determined by the number of votes, even if the margin is small. And the presidential race is determined by the Electoral College, not the popular vote. So lots of people have gone on tangents talking about, just as in 2000, we've got a Republican president who's elected despite not winning a plurality of the popular vote. And the answers are also fairly common. Well, that's the way the system works. The Electoral College is embedded in our process. All of these statements are true in the sense that if the presidential race had been run on a popular vote, nationwide ballot total kind of a stasis, then you would have ended up with different campaigns. You would have ended up with Donald Trump trying to turn out more Republicans in places like Texas and Hillary Clinton trying to turn out more Democrats in places like New York or California. We don't really know what the popular vote outcome would have been, other than to say it's likely it would have been very close. So Donald Trump won the presidency fair and square on the basis of the system that we have, the rules of the game. But it is also fair to point out that he didn't get an overwhelming mandate from the general public of America. Indeed, he got a slightly smaller percentage of the nationwide vote in 2016 than Mitt Romney did in 2012. Now, why did Mitt Romney not become president? Because Barack Obama got a higher percentage, and we didn't have as many third-party candidates getting a larger percentage, and the Electoral College distribution was different. So if Mitt Romney got more votes in Texas and fewer votes in Ohio, that didn't do him any good. If Trump got fewer votes in Texas and more votes in Ohio, that did him a great deal of good. So at the presidential level, there are very important implications for public policy, federal budget, national defense, et cetera. And for North Carolina, the federal situation is that you've got a Republican Congress and an incoming Republican administration and presumably pretty soon a conservative-leaning Supreme Court again, all of which, if the various entities follow their hearts or follow their rhetoric or whatever, means less intrusion onto states and localities. So if the Republican Congress and the Trump administration do what they say they want to do, that will move decisions out to places like Raleigh and Sacramento and Montgomery and Tallahassee. And that means that at the state level, public policy and public officials matter even more.
We're chatting with John Hood. He is chairman of the John Locke Foundation, also president of the John William Pope Foundation. And John, a lot of people look at elections and try to think, okay, what does this mean for the future? If I'm advocating this particular issue or that particular issue or sets of issues, how do I function moving forward? Being in the freedom movement and advocating liberty, what do the elections suggest to you is the course that folks are going to have to follow?
Well, let me give you two observations. One of them is that generally speaking, more often than not, candidates in 2016 who espoused freedom messages, limited government, lower taxes, less regulation, they did better than candidates who advocated larger government. Not in every single race, but in most races this was the case. In most tax increases that were on the ballot in North Carolina, they were defeated, sometimes handily, by the voters. I think that a clear message of the 2016 elections in most races was people want a more fiscally conservative, more freedom-oriented government than they currently have. So that's number one.
And beyond number one, other things that you found?
Well, the other thing I would say is that the coalitions for the two parties are changing, but they're changing on the margins. They didn't – you know, a large number of Republicans didn't walk away from the party because of Donald Trump, or a large number of non-Republicans didn't walk towards the GOP because of Donald Trump. There were some marginal changes. They matter. Again, I just don't want to turn this into some transformational event when it probably isn't quite that.
Knowing what we know about the messages that voters sent about taxes and liberty and freedom, is that a good sign?
I think it is. The other observation I would make very quickly is people's opinions on some matters are fixed and stable. But on other matters, things like foreign policy or trade policy, people's opinions change according to who the leaders are. We tend to think people come up with their ideas and then they shop for a leader who will exemplify those ideas and that's who they vote for. But on a number of issues where people don't have a lot of personal experience, they tend to follow their leaders. So back during the Bush years, most Republicans favored free trade. Today, most Republicans don't favor free trade, according to the fact that a certain percentage of them are following the lead of their presidential candidate. It's not very much difference. There's about as many Trump voters who were in favor of free trade as who were opposed to free trade. But that's a different story than we saw during the Bush years. That's a conformity effect. That means there are some effects of leaders on their followers, and we need to keep that in mind.
And so folks who are advocates of free trade will have to double down on getting that message out and perhaps having a better message.
Absolutely, but also prevail on public officials to make decisions that would then lead people to believe trade is good. In other words, don't give up on the Trump administration or the Republican Congress and assume they used to be for free enterprise and now they're for government control. No, push them to be for free enterprise and the public will follow.
Another potentially good message, I think, for folks who advocate freedom and limited government is the whole anti-crony message that not only Donald Trump but also the very popular Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders even tapped into.
Absolutely. Populism is a very, very real force. You can measure it. You can determine how many people fit the populist category. They have a mixture of views, some of which I, as a free market person, find abhorrent. But others, like opposition to crony capitalism and corruption, are very congenial to me as a limited government person. And I think you, when you're trying to build coalitions and alliances to get things done, you need to find what you have in common, in this case, being against crony capitalism.
And that, of course, is one of the messages sent by this election. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both tapping into this anti-crony sentiment. We know one person who's going to be watching as these events unfold in the weeks and months to come is John Hood. He is chairman of the John Locke Foundation. John, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at carolinajournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. After digging out of a $2.5 billion hole, North Carolina continues to rebuild its reserve fund for unemployment benefits. Ted Brin of the Division of Employment Security recently offered state lawmakers an update.
The trust fund was at $2.214 billion, which is remarkable in the 4-year turnaround. We still seek to be at a level that we believe is what wise people at Department of Labor and other people say we need to be at, which is $2.4 billion, to be able to weather any kind of potential downturn. And I qualify the word any kind based on what we went through in 2008-09. The definition that's likely has changed. But that puts us in a, we believe, a very stable position to be able to weather whatever economic downturns that we see in the near future.
Republican Representative Dana Bumgardner questioned Brin about the trust fund.
You said we needed a balance of $2.4 billion. When do you think we'll get to that number?
Projections are always a little scary, but I feel pretty confident that late April, early May.
Republican Senator Bob Rucho chimed in.
The merit of having those resources, those trust fund monies, upwards of $2.2 billion, are there to protect the citizens when there's an economic downturn and as we've seen just recently, a natural disaster. So in your opinion, as heading this department, do you feel that that is critical, that we maintain that kind of a reserve so that we can react to any kind of episode that might cause problems to the unemployment? Because you are a key component of what is the safety net in North Carolina.
Yes, sir, Senator. I think it's critical to get to that level and do our very best to stay at that level. What that does, also an attribute of that, is it allows us to as we get more and more solvent and ready for any kind of downturns, it allows us at DES to work on process improvement and quality work and things like that. When you're having to think about not having enough money to pay benefits to people that deserve it, then you don't get the time that you need to spend on quality scores and getting things right to begin with in the adjudication process. And it's a very much a pressure relief valve for us to work in this world to have a very solvent unemployment trust fund.
That's Ted Brin of the State Division of Employment Security, updating state lawmakers on efforts to build North Carolina's reserves for unemployment benefits. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. A North Carolina congressman is taking a lead role in one of the most conservative groups on Capitol Hill. Republican Mark Walker has been elected chairman of a group called the Republican Study Committee. During a recent event at the American Enterprise Institute, Walker discussed his top priorities as the group's new chairman.
It's interesting how those have grown exponentially in the last 30 days. Mm-hmm. As a body, we've moved from trying to work hard to throw legislation against the wall and hope that it sticks, as opposed to say, listen, we've got a chance to push forward policy and really laws that impact many generations. A couple of those things that come to my mind is tax reform. Mm-hmm. How many decades have we been talking about tax reform? This administration has added another 8,000 pages of tax code regulations. We're closing in on 75,000 pages now. Small businesses and individuals who get in the crosshairs of the IRS, they don't have a chance. So to be able to literally lay that out, we've got some good ideas, primarily, and still keep three major deductions: higher education, certainly charitable giving, but also something that's a part of the American dream, the mortgage interest rate deduction. Keeping those three, simplifying the tax code, I think that's something that's a huge win that the American people would be, well, they have been clamoring for some time. Obviously, without getting too much to a talking point, the repeal of Obamacare. I enjoyed working with Senator Lee and Rubio as far as some budget reconciliation. This is an opportunity for us to sink our teeth into it very quickly and early on. The reason why I think it's so important of what we do with that repeal, we want to make sure, I know there's arguments on cloture, or the 60, the 51, we've got a standard here. We've got a chance to really go after the heart of Obamacare, even under reconciliation, the 51 majority threshold. I think those two priorities are something that we need to partner, lead out in the RSC, but also hopefully partner with the whole conference to get done very early on in the spring.
Walker also discussed the Republican Study Committee's focus as Congress returns to work on Capitol Hill.
What we're focused on is effective conservatism. And there's no reason that we can't attract, whether it's leadership, there's even a few what they call Tuesday Group members, which is another faction, if you will, as well as the House Freedom Caucus. We have a little bleed over in the RSC from several of those groups, even though we are the largest and historically conservative caucus. What do I mean by effective conservatism? Well, as I've challenged the guys, however long we're privileged to serve here, whether it's 2 years or 20 years, can you look back and say, you know what, was it simply about winning the argument or was it about making a difference? Are there measured marks of success where you've moved the needle forward? Now, I think that consists of three things. One, the right policy. Two, the right approach. And three, the right voice. What I mean by the right voice? If you go back to in business, in marketing, some of you may have worked in that arena, a product can sometimes reach what they call a maturity stage. It's, people are walking past it on the shelf at the grocery store. Kellogg's Corn Flakes had that problem in the late 1980s. So in 1990, they released this commercial. This big New Englander eating this big old bowl of cornflakes. But the tagline was this: taste them again for the first time. And when you talk about with your question as far as the different factions, conservatives as a whole across the conference, I feel like it's hear us again for the first time. We have an opportunity, an incredible moment in history right now, to allow our voices be heard. I don't want to elaborate too long on this, but that's where I believe the approach is incredibly important. Republicans and conservatives specifically many times are guilty of simply preaching to the choir. Right. That's our culture. That's where the, if you want to use the metaphor continue or the analogy, that's where the amens are. That's the easy place. But the aspect of, or the goal should be, how do we get that conservative message into new communities, into new places? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not always leading with a policy, but it's leading by the relationship. Mm-hmm. To visit, to listen, to grow those relationships. In the sense, I'll give you an example. If you go to look at a new car or used car and you go on the lot and you're looking at all the different bells and whistles, if I'm the salesman and I sit there and look at your used car and say, that's the nastiest piece of automotive that I've ever seen in my life, well, there's automatically a defensive nature or flag that comes up. We've got to do better across the board as conservatives, and I believe that really comes down to our messaging. That's what drove me to run for Congress originally. We're going to stay consistent with that, and I believe the RSC provides an incredible place to exhibit that conservatism across the board, whether you're in leadership, whether you're in the Freedom Caucus, or whether you're in Tuesday's groups as well.
That's North Carolina Congressman Mark Walker, newly elected chairman of the Conservative Republican Study Committee. During his speech to the American Enterprise Institute, Walker also emphasized the importance of making policy arguments that make sense to real people.
I have one of the, if not the finest, legislative director, Dwayne Carson, who's here today. But there are times I disappoint him when he gets into these 30-minute policy rants and when I have to say, I don't think the people care. And what I mean by that, even though it's very valuable to have the depth and comprehensive policy, I liken this. I'm married to a family nurse practitioner, trauma nurse, who flies on a helicopter and does real work. If I'm in that situation where I'm needing that attention, I don't really want to care or hear about the Hippocratic Oath or how many cc's I'm going to need to make my pain go away. I just feel like there's a crisis and we need some help. That's where the American people are. So when we get in all in this policy elitism talk, and we just need to make sure that our messaging is very strong. When I first began to think about running for office and still a minister, I remember attending the Republican National Convention in Tampa in 2012. I wasn't a delegate. Found a ticket, found some lodging, and went down there and just was kind of looking all around. And one of the things that I noticed was this great lip service and genuine intentionality about reaching all communities and different youth and generations of minorities. And as soon as we finished the speech, they, you know, and now put your hands together for the Oak Ridge Boys. And what gathered in that moment was what we were doing versus what we were saying was a contrast. And I feel like to answer the questions for us where we need to go at this point, we need to make sure as we talk to the American people that we're able to do, not in these condescending terms of political Greek and Latin, but to be able to say, listen, this is where you're hurting. We're at point A. We need to get to point B, and here's the two or three steps that we can get there. I believe if we're able to do that and communicate in a way, we're going to have buy-in that maybe we haven't seen in some generations.
Yep. Walker touched on the difficulty of forging bipartisan relationships on Capitol Hill.
It is an environment where, whether it's the outside groups or other entities, press, you want to name it, we're in this boxing ring, and we're having to dodge and bob and weave and move our feet at the same time. So it's very difficult. The real place where that can develop most is at the local level. As this thing grows up, it actually augments or spreads out more and makes it more challenging. It doesn't delineate our responsibility to make every effort that we can, whether you grab a dinner or whether you're going out and playing some sports together or whatever it might be. That's an opportunity, and if you always use it, it does dumb down a little bit that harsh rhetoric that sometimes we see in D.C.
Republicans now control the White House along with both chambers of Congress, but Walker says that should remind the GOP of a lesson he learned watching the legendary Alabama football coach Bear Bryant win with humility.
We don't have to spike the football because we have to ask ourselves long-term, what's our end goal? Is it to accomplish? Is it to, as you suggested, to build those bipartisanship relationships? There's a moment here. We're ahead. We're winning. We can go out and we can attack, or we can say, you know what? Let's revisit some of this. Now, is that a little bit of a Pollyanna viewpoint? It is. But if it, even if it moves a few percentage points, whether it's here in Congress or in our districts, I believe that's a big win for us.
That's Mark Walker, Republican U.S. Representative for North Carolina's 6th District. He's also the newly elected chairman of the influential Conservative Republican Study Committee. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina's U.S. congressional delegation has quickly become a coalition of leaders. At least two Republican members of that delegation are now serving in key roles beyond service to their districts. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He joins me now to talk about two particular members of Congress. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Let's talk first about Congressman Mark Meadows. He is now taking a position in a pretty important caucus.
Yes, he has become the head of the Republican Freedom Caucus, or excuse me, the House Freedom Caucus, which is a group of conservative Republicans who articulate a very much of a principled limited government position on a number of issues, and he's about to start his third term in the U.S. House. The Freedom Caucus is an offshoot of something we're going to talk about later called the Republican Study Committee. And this is the group that has worked a lot for tax cuts. It's worked a lot toward coming up with proposals for repealing Obamacare. It's been very active in regulatory reform and in all sorts of issues that are very important to the conservatives across the country.
And it has been a thorn in the side to some of the leadership in the U.S. Congress over the past several years, because these folks are fiscal conservatives. They're very concerned about the size and scope of government. And there have been times when Republicans themselves, other Republicans, have really made votes that would expand government and expand spending.
Yes, they've been adamant opponents of earmarks. They have been certainly opponents of pork barrel spending, and there have been times when they have threatened to withhold their support from legislation that's been supported by the House leadership, and their threat to withhold support for that legislation may well have led it to be changed in a more conservative direction. And so what they've done is they've used their leverage. I think there are about 40 of them or something like that. And they've used that leverage in a House that has less than a 40 member majority to move legislation in their direction. And they've had a pretty good relationship with Speaker Paul Ryan. But previously with John Boehner, it was a much more
bad
rocky relationship. Yes.
And they are big enough that they simply can't be ignored.
That's right. That's right. And they also tend to be very cohesive as well. And so they do tend, once they take a position, they tend to move forward with some unanimity in that position.
Mark Meadows really does seem to have developed a very public profile. He does a lot of national cable network mm-hmm. news programs. You see him a lot. You read about him a lot. How is it that someone such as Congressman Meadows has become so public so quickly?
Well, he's very affable, for one thing. He has a reputation as being somebody who gets along very well with members of his own caucus and also has, I think, some fairly cordial relations with members of the Democratic caucus. Of course, he's very media-friendly, so he's someone who's very accessible. And he's someone who just seems to have a natural affinity for the public setting. And so that certainly helps when you're in a position in which you're trying to articulate a minority position, because the House Freedom Caucus position is not the position that is necessarily the position of the Republican caucus as a whole.
Right.
But he is very articulate in pressing that agenda, and also he does so in a way that's, you know, that's forceful, but that is not perceived as nasty or any kind of, you know, he's not snarky about it at all.
Now, his 6th District colleague, Congressman Mark Walker, also is in a new leadership role, and it's with a group you mentioned a couple minutes ago called the Republican Study Committee.
Yes, and this is in some ways even more surprising because Mark Walker currently is a freshman member of Congress. He is just entering his second term and will in January, and so he's risen to this, and the Republican Study Committee has had more direct influence over the years than the Freedom Caucus has, certainly. In fact, the Freedom Caucus was sort of broke off from the study committee because the study committee is essentially the policymaking caucus of the House Republicans. So this is where different sorts of alternatives to administration legislation will come forward if the administration has an agenda that's different than that of the House Republicans. And also it's a place where they craft their own legislation that's sometimes outside the regular committee structure. And so if the Ways and Means Committee is looking at a tax package, the study committee may actually go forward and do some research about it and sort of add some meat to the bones, if you will, before they put forward an agenda. Now, the study committee, very famously, was one of the sources of what became the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation was in some ways a think tank that provided research for the study committee way back when. So it's been around for a long time. It still has a great deal of influence. It's more accommodating toward the leadership than the Freedom Caucus is. So it tends to be the policymaking wing for the leadership's perspective on something. And the fact that you have Mark Walker, who is such a junior member of Congress, to be chairing that is really a feather in his cap.
But they are not the only two among the North Carolina congressional delegation. There are several other members mm-hmm. who are very well respected among the entire U.S. Congress. One of them is 5th District Congresswoman Virginia Fox, and she has several plum assignments. She has served as the Secretary of the Republican Conference and now Chair of the House Committee on Education and the Workforce.
Yes, that's a huge plum assignment for her. She has been previously was chairing their subcommittee on higher education policy. She's someone who is a former teacher, also was, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, a board member or official in the community college system.
I think
and
you're
so
right. Mm-hmm.
And so she is someone who has great ties to higher education and also has ties to the more you know, technical and career-oriented aspects of higher education. And now she's actually going to be the top House Republican dealing with education policy and also dealing with labor policy as well. And so this is something that's going to be, again, a very important assignment and something that's going to be someplace where North Carolina and the basically, the role of North Carolina's community colleges and technical schools and training institutions and the like, her expertise there will be felt, and North Carolina's influence will be felt there.
Rick, are we looking at a future House Speaker among the North Carolina congressional delegation?
It's indeed possible. I mean, you can conceivably imagine Mark Meadows as being one now. Someone who's actually in the leadership now is Patrick McHenry of the 11th District, the 10th District, who is one of the deputy whips. That has been a post from which several speakers have come in the past decades. And so it's a possibility that Patrick McHenry is someone who would be considered along those lines. But you have people like 8th District Richard Hudson, who's very active in the military community, who may well consider, if he doesn't run for statewide office, may well look toward a leadership position in the House as well.
And on the Democratic side, you have Congressman G.K. Butterfield in charge of the Congressional Black Caucus, so
that's
a
right.
Very plum position as well on the other side of the aisle there. Well, we've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal about North Carolina's U.S. congressional delegation and several members taking leadership roles in the Congress. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.